The date is July 2nd, 1996, and we're watching Independence Day. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Captain Stephen Hiller to my David Levinson.
Let's kick the tires and light some fires. It's Colin Stewart.
And this week, it's a big party here for us on our show. We have our party hats on, our streamers, our noisemakers, and it's a triple celebration as well, because it was Canada Day for us here yesterday up in Canada. It's the 4th of July on the weekend, and it's also the literal 25th anniversary of this movie, 25 years ago today, if you're listening to this on the release day. So we need to bring back one of our favorite guest stars, and a guest star that has been petitioned in our reviews to come back as often as he can. So welcome back our friend of the show, Joel Sims. Joel, welcome back.
Hello, thank you for having me. If you two are the stars, does that make me the drunk pilot?
Okay, if that's the route you want to go. I was going to say this is our president, Thomas J. Whitmore.
See, but I like that more. I can give a rousing speech or two, depending on the mood and how many drinks I've had. So
excellent.
So this week, we're looking back at July 1996, when the movies in theaters were The Rock, The Cable Guy, The Phantom, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and of course our movie for today, Independence Day, which earned $817.4 million on a $75 million budget, making it the highest grossing movie of 1996.
Wow, I did not know that. But as always, there will be spoilers ahead, so if you do not want this 25-year-old movie to be spoiled for you, please hit pause, go watch it, and then come back, hit play, and hear what we have to say.
Yeah, to watch it, it'll be easy. It'll be on any channel, on any TV that you find at like 10 o'clock.
Yeah, probably.
I imagine that Independence Day is one of those movies that TBS or TNT displays 24 hours a day on a constant rotation over the Independence Day weekend, so...
Well, I'm wondering, now that Fox stuff is on Disney Plus, do you think that they're holding back some of their movies so that they can be the ones to reap all the benefits?
Yeah, I don't know.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie as well, Fast and the Furious was the big one for sponsors. This one has all the taglines, 9 total I found. First, we've always believed we weren't alone. On July 4th, we'll wish we were.
That one's, I like it. I'm on board. I'm on board with that one.
Second, I get it. Mm-hmm.
Earth, take a good look. It could be your last.
Not my favorite.
Third, we've got the question of whether or not we are alone in the universe has been answered. And one of the posters I looked at, that was above the title, and it was paired with the next one, which is Don't Make Plans for August.
Ooh, I like Don't Make Plans for August. That one,
and they give you the old 1-2 buckle your shoe by hitting you with 2 taglines on the poster. So that was a pretty good one, I thought. Yeah. So fifth, they only want one thing: destruction. Sixth, we've got warning: your next stop may not be there. I'm thinking that this may have been a bus or a subway ad. Seventh, we've got on July 2nd they arrive. On July 3rd they strike. On July 4th. We fight back.
Ooh, that one's very American, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel the red, white, and blue coursing through my veins.
Yeah! I almost bet that tagline was written wherever it was in red, white, and blue letters. Each sentence was a different color. Yeah. Eighth, we've got Enjoy the Super Bowl. It may be your last. And obviously that was a Super Bowl ad. And finally, today, the human race celebrates their Independence Day. Some of that cocky American arrogance that comes through at the end of the movie, right there in the tagline.
Yeah.
That's a ton, but it may not be the best description of this movie still. So let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
Okay. When aliens from another world invade the Earth and start blowing shit up, It's up to a crop duster, a fighter pilot, a scientist, and the president of the goddamn United States to save the day. It's War of the Worlds meets the Queen's Gambit as humanity battles the aliens in a military chess match where the fate of the entire world is at stake. Will the world go quietly into the night? Will humanity vanish without a fight? Will good old-fashioned American chutzpah be able to withstand advanced alien technology? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
It's got the sign off from me. Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks, guys.
So, Joel, what kind of experience do you have with Independence Day?
Well, personally, I've always been a big fan of this movie. When I was a kid, I remember watching it for the first time, and just like the visual of the White House blowing up.
Yeah.
A, inspired a lot of, like, you know, pride in myself as a Canadian going, we did it first.
Yeah, true.
You know,
true.
Same idea.
Yeah.
I just remember being absolutely blown away by it. I remember when I was younger, I thought that Will Smith was like the coolest guy ever because my dad was in the Air Force.
Yes.
And so I had that connection there. Yeah, I've always loved it. Like I said, this movie is on every channel all the time, no matter the year. You can find Independence Day on your TV at like late night TBS. Mm-hmm. 3 in the morning. It's always there for you, like an old friend.
Yeah. Well, thank you to your father for his service from us. What about you, Colin? What's your experience with Independence Day?
I remember I had a friend when I was in elementary school who, for whatever reason, introduced me to this movie. I think his family had gotten it on VHS and I'd never seen it before.
Okay.
And I remember just loving it so much. And I think it was also, like, Men in Black was maybe a year after this.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it kind of started my obsession. I had, like, a little bit of an obsession for a while with Will Smith, kind of like what Joel was saying. And, like, he was just, like, the coolest guy.
Well, yeah, he came out of the gate hard with a couple of solid movies between this and Men in Black. So being a Fresh Prince fan, that was the exciting thing is, oh, he can do action too. He's funny and he can do action.
I also think this was like the first big blockbuster movie I ever watched.
Mm-hmm.
And even like disaster alien movies. Like, I don't think I'd ever watched like a real big summer blockbuster alien movie before Independence Day. So that's kind of where it stands in my memory.
Yeah, I know this is one that I do like my occasional mindless movie that you don't have to think at all.
Mm-hmm.
Citizen Kane.
Yeah. All those non-thinkers, you don't need to have your brain on for any of those. So I feel kind of probably the same way as Colin, where it's just like, I mean, this almost feels like one of the first actual summer blockbusters that, like, not even the first one that we saw. Like, this kind of seemed to be the one that was the catalyst for all future summer blockbusters that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just gave me a lifelong love of Will Smith, that's for sure.
This movie gives me real Michael Bay vibes. It's almost surprising that
it's not a Bay movie. Yeah, Roland Emmerich, he is pretty much the same. Well, let's jump right into Independence Day here, because it is directed by Roland Emmerich. But yeah, his disaster movies are usually things like 2012, The Day After Tomorrow, Godzilla, Stargate. So he does like these big flashy movies, just like Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer do. It's produced by Dean Devlin, who produced the sequel, Eight-Legged Freaks, Stargate, Godzilla, and the Godzilla TV series? Cartoon? I don't know if I knew this existed.
Well, I mean, I think anybody who's seen Godzilla 2000 wants to forget that they saw Godzilla 2000. Well, and with that would also go forgetting that there was a cartoon show based on what I believe to be one of the worst made movies ever.
Well, so is that what it's based on? Because, like, the Godzilla I'm talking about is the Matthew Broderick one that came out before Godzilla 2000.
Yeah, wasn't the Matthew Broderick one the one with the line, that's a lot of fish? Know where that came from?
Yeah, I think so.
In my mind, the Matthew Broderick one is Godzilla 2000.
No, they are different movies.
Mm.
Yeah, Godzilla 2000 was a return to the guy in the rubber suit.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm talking about the Matthew Broderick one. That's what I mean. And yeah, the cartoon was based on that movie.
Oh, that's even worse then. I don't know. I think I liked Godzilla 2000 a little bit more than, well, maybe not. I don't know. None of them are very good.
The only thing I remember from that Godzilla movie is the Puff Daddy song. That was the only thing good about it.
And I think back when he was still Puff Daddy, right? Like, before he went to P. Diddy and Diddy Kong and Diddy Diddy Doo Dah, you know, all those things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by those two same guys, Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin. And so we open the movie on the fun, explosive credits, where it's like three-dimensional credits that are flipping around. And we're told it's July 2nd. Look at that, boys. Everything comes full circle. Everything is July 2nd today. And we see the American flag on the moon, and something is vibrating the moon, and a shadow falls over the landing site, and here we go. We're into it. I love that they just jump right in. You know, no huge buildup. They show you the ship within the first 2 minutes.
Yeah, no holds barred. They immediately just, like, show you the scale of it, too. Like, they let you know, like, this thing coming towards the Earth, and they're fucked.
Yep.
Like...
Yeah, there's something about when the ship crosses over the moon and they show the vibration of the ship erasing the first astronaut's footprints that just, yeah. I'm like, this movie is all about an affront to America and how America responds to, like,
yeah,
its history being taken.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't have a shot of the American flag falling over even, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they have that close-up of the Statue of Liberty, but I'm also surprised there wasn't a shot of, like, the Statue of Liberty just being taken out.
Yeah. So we cut to the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute in New Mexico, or SETI. I think I would enjoy working there. Like, you're basically just sitting around all day doing nothing. They have a putting green set up. And in 1996, this is before smartphones and streaming. It seems like a pretty cush job. How do we get on at SETI?
I don't know. This guy's just working on his stroke all day. Like, he's not not doing nothing. He's just working on the short game. I wonder if they have, like, a chipping green and, like, a back room as well, you know?
Yeah.
Probably got some cornhole going on Friday.
But finally, after all these years of being SETI, they do hear a sound. You know, this is what we've been training for, people. They have to wake someone up in bed, but I guess he just lives off to the side of the control room because he shows up in pajamas.
Yeah, I was confused by the scale of that.
Yeah.
Because again, he answers the call, he hits his head, which shows he's on, like, a bunk bed, and then he's in the room.
Yeah. And, like, so is SETI just that much out in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico?
I mean, it must be in somewhere pretty remote that they wouldn't want people knowing where it is, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So the idea would be maybe that you go out there and you stay for a while so that no one's, like, no weird ET looky-loo is tracking your motions back to this base.
Yeah. It's next door to Area 51. That's where it is, I guess.
Same homeowners association.
Yeah. We cut to Space Command at the Pentagon and meet General William Gray, who is played by Robert Loggia. I read that Roland Emmerich recommended to Robert Loggia to go watch another movie for inspiration, but the problem is he meant to say airport, but actually told him to go watch Airplane. Mm. So all of a sudden, Robert Loggia was afraid that he was in some stupid spoof movie. I thought that was an absolute beautiful story. Now we also meet President Thomas J. Whitmore, who is played by Bill Pullman, who reprises the character in the sequel. The role was written for Kevin Spacey, though, but the studio didn't think he had star potential.
Hmm. Now I'm
whatever happened to that guy?
Yeah.
No, what's he been up to? I haven't seen him in a while.
I'm just imagining Frank Underwood as the president in Independence Day now.
It's also Kevin Spacey in the weird YouTube video he released after his career went down, like a, you know, like the White House in Independence Day. It just blew up.
Yeah.
To where he played Frank Underwood, but without explicitly saying it, while throwing stuff into a fire.
Yeah.
Classic. Thank you, Kevin. Fucking weirdo.
Classic Spacey.
Golly gee. So we find out that the president's approval ratings are slipping, his wife is out of town, and his daughter Patricia slept in his bed overnight. She is played by Mae Whitman. She played one of my favorite characters, Ann Veal. Did either of you watch Arrested Development?
Not enough of it to remember Ann Veal.
Ann Veal is Michael Cera's unmemorable girlfriend. The joke is they made her so unmemorable that she was actually played by two different actresses.
That's funny.
The president gets the call from the Secretary of Defense about the UFO, and oh my god, just already, we're only a few minutes into the movie, and there's already been so many patriotic images. Like, you had mentioned the Statue of Liberty one, that's where this falls in, but we also have the American flag on the White House and all these things, and it's always punctuated with those weird zoom-ins that he does, or... it's just... Ugh. If the patriotic images were sugar and I was diabetic, I'd be dead. So we meet David Levinson, who is played by Jeff Goldblum, who reprises the role in the sequel, and, you know, just the man that oozes sexuality. I did read, though, that David Levinson could have been played by Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, I can see that. Because, I mean, this is like Jeff Goldblum before I feel like, I don't know when it happened, but Jeff Goldblum hit a spot where he just, like, stopped talking and just was, like, mumbling sexually all the time, it seems. At some point in his acting career, I don't think there's
a better way to put it.
Yeah, he really played into that aspect of his acting ability. Mm-hmm. But this was before that, so I could see Matthew Broderick being okay.
Well, this would have been, like, a couple years after the first Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of Malcolm from Jurassic Park is where he started finding that, I don't know, that caricature of Jeff Goldblum that Jeff Goldblum has become. But I love Jeff Goldblum. He's always cool, no matter
that
where he shows up.
Suaveness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we also meet his dad, Julius Levinson, who is played by Judd Hirsch, who reprises the role in the sequel. He was in Taxi, Dear John. The two of them are playing chess in the park. David is an environmentalist and still wears his wedding ring because he isn't over his ex-wife. And chess, we will definitely soon find out, is one of his most defining character traits.
Yeah.
Why is he so obsessed with making everything a chess metaphor in this movie?
Yeah,
I feel like that's a really common trope across, like, most media is, like, chess guys. It's like, that's their life. They're like, you know, everything's a game of chess. Everything's just, you know, following one move after the other and always having to predict, you know.
If they're a smart guy, it definitely has to be, yeah.
Oh, yeah. If you're a smart guy in media, the audience doesn't know that you're a smart guy because, as we all know, the audience is as dumb as a sack of hammers unless you're playing chess, which is a symbol of intelligence.
There we go.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think that chess is like a universal metaphor for logic and reasoning. Mm-hmm. And so it's like when you have chess,
yeah,
because chess is not a game of chance or whatever. So I think when you have people like that, it can ground the story a little bit when you think of something as a chess match, as opposed to, like, you could just get lucky and win. They could have just got lucky and beat the aliens, I guess.
Well, see, now, football is something that people always refer to as a sport that is like a chess match. And with how patriotic everything is in this movie, you'd almost think that he should have gone for a bunch of football metaphors instead.
You think that they should have started the movie with Jeff Goldblum, like, quarterbacking for the Patriots?
Yeah, there you go.
What, in the huddle, like, throwing a touchdown instead of playing chess with his dad?
Yeah, yeah. Now we cut to meet Russell, who is played by Randy Quaid, who plays Cousin Eddie from Vacation movies. And, I mean, you know, just kind of has sort of become his own version of Eddie in his later life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his kids, Alicia, Troy, and Miguel, they are his kids, right? Like, they never really give any real backstory to explain why these kids look so different.
Yeah, they're his kids, just based on the end.
Yeah.
Things go down.
Yeah. Like, it's just even their relationship with him. Is it just because he's an alcoholic that this relationship is so strained? Because it just, I don't know. I got stepkid vibes off of a couple of them, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me not being a bit oblivious, but, like, with Miguel, you can't even really tell that he's, like, one of the guys. He's just kind of hanging out, and all of a sudden they're, you know, in the camper van going across the country.
Yeah. But yes, Russell is a crop duster and a bit of a weirdo and a drunk. And supposedly got abducted by aliens, we find out in the later scenes as well. And he has just crop dusted the wrong field. And then we go back to the ships. We get to see the ships detach from the mothership. And so, okay, they said in the movie, I'm sure they said that each of them was 4 miles in width. But then I read something that says that when you actually look at the size of them, they're about 15 miles in width. I don't know. Looking at them over the cities, what do you think? Is it 4 miles or 15 miles that these things are?
Well, I mean, I have to go. I would go on the scene where the ship is over the White House. It definitely seems smaller than 15 miles in width to me.
Yeah.
But there's also like the scene where it's flying over the Chrysler building in New York. And it's like, you can't see anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, like when you see the scene where it's like coming out of the clouds, like it's bursting through the clouds, it looks massive.
Yeah, there's like the scene where Will Smith and his girlfriend at the time were in the desert and he like steps outside and he's looking and she's like, what are you looking at? later on they show what they saw, and it looks
yeah,
massive. I feel like 15 miles.
Yeah, for sure.
We are but filthy Canadians using things like kilometers instead of miles, but...
I mean, yeah, next time I'll have to take my ruler out and measure the top of the White House, find out how exactly long that would be, and then gauge based on that the size of the ship above it.
Have to break out like the protractor, you know, get some exact measurements going.
So the first ship gets spotted in Iraq. It's interesting that everybody, no matter where they are, the Persian Gulf, SETI, the White House, they all seem to be getting woken up and putting on clothes. Like, we've got the guy in the submarine in the Persian Gulf who is, like, just buttoning up his shirt saying, this better be good. Why is everywhere in the world just waking up for the day?
Because no matter where they are, they're on American time.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. It's like, you know, some people say it's like, you know, America runs on Duncan. The world runs on America. Yeah. This is a Hollywood movie. They really need to nail in the worldly centrism of American media, where no other countries exist. And also California is its own country somehow.
Yeah. But okay, so the ships, they all come into the atmosphere, though, and they like bring in this cloud of fire. Is this just from entering the atmosphere? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, maybe. They must be moving relatively fast. They just look slower, maybe because of their size.
Yeah.
So yeah, if they're entering the atmosphere, it seems reasonable that there would be, like, some heat.
Yeah. But yeah, so they send up a plane to go investigate one of these fireballs, and it ends up exploding! And they want to hide the president, but he refuses to leave. He's a trooper.
What a hero.
God bless you, Mr. President.
He's got my vote.
So, David, meanwhile, has been living in his own little world back at work and figuring out how to get rid of the distortion, and has figured out that there is a descending countdown code hidden. Oh, dear. This is not going to end well. Now we cut and meet Captain Stephen Hiller, who is played by Will Smith. I read that the writer and director really wanted a black lead for this movie. And so their first choice was actually Eddie Murphy. However, they got a little pushback from the studio, and they came back with other choices of Tom Cruise, Keanu Reeves, Johnny Depp, Jean-Claude Van Damme, or William Baldwin
as my favorite black actor.
Yeah. I don't even know, though, how I would have felt about Eddie Murphy in the lead. Will Smith just has a stud quality.
Like, he was exactly what this movie needed. I don't think that this movie would have been as successful as it was if it weren't for Will Smith's performance.
Mm-hmm. And my God, do I love when he teams up with Jeff Goldblum. Like, the two of them are a good duo. I am so upset that Will Smith didn't come back for the sequel to just see that bromance again.
They have such a weirdly natural charisma on screen. Like, I've read that most of their dialogue was improvised. Mm-hmm. And it's totally clear because, again, they have such like a, their interactions are so fluid and so human. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It blows me away. I agree. Yeah. Why'd you have to be doing Suicide Squad, Will? It could come back for Independence Day too.
Yeah. Do you want one flaming pile of shit or the other flaming pile of shit?
Academy Award winning flaming pile of shit. Gotta give Suicide Squad the respect it deserves.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, if he had been in Independence Day 2, it probably wouldn't have been as much of a garbage fire as it turned out to be. I haven't even seen it. That's a movie I refuse to watch.
I've watched it once, and I know that I was tempted to put it on immediately following this one. I'm like, no, I don't have it in me.
You made the right choice.
In this scene, we also meet Jasmine Dubrow, who is played by Vivica A. Fox, who was in the sequels. I read that Jada Pinkett Smith was a possibility for this role.
Was that when she was still Miss Jada Pinkett, or when she was Miss Jada Pinkett Smith?
Nope. Ah. Yeah, that was before she had the hyphenate, yeah. And we also meet Little Dylan, who is played by Ross Bagley, who played Nikki in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air at the same time. I never realized that Nikki was on the show for 48 episodes. I didn't think that character was on that show for that long.
I can like barely remember him when I think about it. I've seen every episode.
I don't even remember him.
Well, it was that weird, like, with two seasons left to go, they decided to make Aunt Viv pregnant, and then all of a sudden the next season the kid was like 6 years old.
There's something in the breast milk, you know? They used formula instead of milk.
It's all that Bel-Air living. And so we get our montage of all the ships getting into position all over the world. You know, like New York and Los Angeles. So international do they... Like, I was always disappointed that there was never a over-the-CN Tower ship. You know, they never really show you anything except for the American perspective for the most part.
Why wasn't there one over the legislature building? Come on. Yeah,
there you go. Aliens, come attack us! Putting this one out into the universe.
We matter too, damn it.
But all the people in New York look up. And it's interesting to think how 1996 people would all look up because they're not busy looking at their phones. Hashtag social commentary.
That's deep, man. That's a really deep cut. Probably took you a while to think of that.
But still, like, the basketball players are looking out. Cars are crashing because they're not even watching the road anymore. Like, it is true, though, that it's bizarre that it would get that many people's attention all at once.
My favorite is that everybody keeps crashing their cars and nobody even cares.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are, like, absolutely having their cars get obliterated and they're just like, eh.
Yeah, no one gets out holding their neck.
Yeah, I'd be a little annoyed. I'd be a little skeezed, you know? I'd be like, yeah, it's my Prius, you know?
But yeah, panic is breaking out and we've got looting and all that shit going on. David realizes that there's something about the signal that's like chess. They're positioning their pieces and there's a countdown. What happens when this gets to zero and then very dramatically says, checkmate.
Dun, dun, dun.
Checkmate. So luckily we'll find out that David has an in at the White House because his ex-wife Connie, or Constance Spano, played by Margaret Collin, she works at the White House. I read Ali Walker, whoever that is, could have been Connie, just for shits and giggles. Anyone that's a big Ali Walker fan out there, I'm not sure.
Oh, I got a poster of her on my wall.
Oh, well, there you go. She could have been in this movie, Joel.
Oh, my favorite. How could she not have been? She would have been so good. She's so good in all those other things she's done.
What is Connie to the president? Who is she?
I think she's like a assistant, like almost like keeps like the schedule in order and all that kind of thing. I think they're called like an EA, like an executive assistant.
Okay. And then we cut back to Stephen Hiller. I still love about the whole bit about how he finds out about the aliens. You know, he stumbles to the curb. He's tripping over toys. He's yawning with his cup of coffee, picks up his paper, and then just kind of looks around him and realizes that, hey, everybody's moving. Like, he had the line earlier where he says that, hey, neighbors are moving, while he's taking a leak. But yeah, I just love, though, how you see it dawn on him that, wait a minute, everybody is fucking crazy. What's going on here?
Yeah, I like that he's assuming it's just because of the earthquakes.
Yeah, that too. Telling. Yeah, but he packs up and he takes off because he's a military man and he needs to report, even though he was supposed to have the weekend of the 4th off.
I find it so weird that they keep saying these base names like people are going to know what that means. Like, he's all about, oh, I need to report to El Toro.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, good for you.
Like, nice, man. Like, sweet. Like,
but I'm wondering if people in the States are like, oh, it's my base.
And then we get a moment of Randy Quaid being crazy. He's yelling on the news about having been abducted by aliens. With everything else going on, how has this guy made the news?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just like local news.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems weird that they highlight this crazy guy that says he was abducted by aliens. It's like, well, we see that there's aliens. Who cares about whether you were or weren't?
It's like, yeah, real slow news day, huh? You know, the world's ending. Yeah, you know. Is there a kitten stuck in a tree or something that you couldn't have talked about?
Yeah, a water skiing squirrel or something. Yeah.
I feel like they would just be combing for any alien-related story.
True.
Everybody knows what's going on, so then the news is trying to like lend context, so then they would have all these like loonies talking about their experiences with aliens and anal probes and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I mean, I found it funny that he was newsworthy because, like, we even see that he shows up back at his trailer and his kids are like, why are you here? And he goes, well, they let me out because there's they've got bigger fish to fry. Like, it's I'm surprised the news didn't have bigger fish to fry in this situation. But we cut back to Stephen Hiller now, who has gotten to the base, and we get to meet Captain Jimmy Wilder, played by Harry Connick Jr., who I read could have been played by Matthew Perry. He was actually cast, and he backed out at the last minute. Chandler Bing.
Do you even know how to fly a plane?
It's like a nasally upwards inflection with every line. Yeah, that's what you need.
Yeah, could you invade us anymore? Yeah, that's... Yeah. What is with Harry Connick Jr.'s, like, really weird, like, all his booty talk?
I don't know. I feel like that character is just so odd.
Yeah.
You know, 96, that was a boob man's time, you know? But he was fighting the good fight for all the ass men out there, you know, keeping it real.
It all turned around when Beyonce came out with Bootylicious, right?
Of course, yeah.
And the thong song.
Yeah, the thong song was pre-Bootylicious as well.
I do believe.
But I mean, what about Baby Got Back was before, before all of that?
Yeah. That was the precursor, yeah.
Yeah. Even Will Smith, wasn't he getting jiggy with it? Doesn't that have something to do with asses? No? I don't know.
Not good old family-friendly Will Smith. Yeah. He meant he was just cutting a rug.
But then we also get the hilarious misunderstanding when Captain Wilder picks up the ring and it looks like he's proposing when another soldier walks around the corner. But I do have to admit that I appreciate that it's done innocently as far as I can tell. It's not, whoa. We didn't drop an F-bomb in that moment where it's like, whoa, okay, couple of queers over here. Like, you know.
Yeah.
It was just, hey, okay, you guys do your thing.
You guys do you? Yeah, the joke wasn't like, ew.
Yeah.
Ew, dude, that's nasty. It was like that. Yeah.
So we basically see that society is crumbling. No one can handle this. These aliens are being handled like the COVID pandemic. Hashtag social commentary. What? Come at me.
Deep cut.
Oh, boy. So David gets to the White House. I love the old technology here, where David has a disc that he puts into his laptop, and it has every phone book in America on it. And he even says how it will have her portable telephone. She always has a portable telephone listed in case of emergencies. Old tech. Gotta love it. And so Connie ends up letting David into the White House. And I love the whole backstory, though, about punching the president. He wasn't the president then. You punched the president?
I think they just move on from it. I don't think it gets addressed again. Like, I don't think that there's a line from the president or anything.
Yeah. Like, later on, it could even be like, well, okay, we're even now. Like, that's what he could have been when he saved the world.
Something.
Yeah, we're even for you punching me.
Mm-hmm.
A callback at the end. But meanwhile, the welcome wagon is doing its thing, that helicopter with the lights. I don't understand the science behind the light show on the helicopter. Like, how is this a visual greeting?
Maybe it's like flash signals of some sort, like Morse code or something.
Yeah, but that would mean nothing to anyone. And it's not really Morse code. I mean, it's like it's got like weird designs happening and weird pulsing.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I just don't know what they're trying to achieve with this. But they think it's going to work. But they got to get those helicopters back from the ship because, well, we're leaving. Looks like David got through to the right man. Luckily, the only guy that was smart enough to find this signal happened to have been married to the aide of the President of the United States. But they get to ride on the Air Force One helicopter, or is it Marine One with the helicopter? I think it might be Marine One.
No, Marine One would be a ship of some sort.
Yeah, like I think that Air Force like One is a title that automatically goes to whatever plane, helicopter, whatever the President of the United States is going to be flying in. That's always Air Force One.
Yeah, see, but I thought the helicopter had a different name. Okay, well, some American listener, tweet at us. Go ahead, tell me if I'm wrong.
Let us know. Educate us, filthy Canadians.
And then they get on the plane, or on the helicopter, and I love how excited Julius is about the fact that there's a phone on there. Oh, we have our own phone! In LA, we see that the First Lady gets evacuated, and Jasmine's stripper friend makes it to one of the crazy people parties just in time for Jeff Goldblum to dramatically say, "Time's up," and everything just goes fucking boom! National monuments destroyed. Oh, I love these effects. I mean,
so good.
Mm-hmm.
Always love them. Hollywood needs to go back to miniature models more, because that's the beauty of using the miniatures, is it's even 25 years later, it's such a solid effect still. So much fire. It's so beautiful. And I read that the movie actually still holds the record for the most miniature work in a film.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
I did also read that Roland Emmerich refused to sit next to Bill Clinton at the White House screening of this film because he was worried about how Bill Clinton would react to the White House being blown up. So he made Bill Pullman sit next to him instead.
He just didn't like his politics.
Yeah, maybe.
He was like, "Sorry, Bill. I know things already that the rest of the world is going to be real shocked to hear."
I don't know the timeline. I don't know if this was pre-Lewinsky or post-Lewinsky or pre-playing saxophone on The Tonight Show or post, you know.
I feel like it would have been right all up in it.
It's all up in something. So when everything is blowing up, it's also pretty impressive when we see Jasmine manages to kick a door down that has a padlock on it. Those hooker legs are strong, I guess. Or those stripper legs are strong, I guess.
I was about to say, like, she's working a different kind of pole, my friend. Give her some respect. Right.
I didn't mean to go all the way in with hooker.
That's
aggressive. I absolutely love this scene. I have this scene like burned into my head. There's a couple scenes that really come to mind when I think of Independence Day. One of them is like the, as you referred to, the crazy people party on the top of that helicopter pad getting blown up, and then like the White House and all that. This is another one of them, because for some reason, it's so funny to me. They really emphasize that Boomer Live.
Yeah.
I think that's the name. They were like, the world needs to know that the dog was sitting here watching the explosion until he heard his name called, to which he parkoured and airbutted his way across a bunch of cars to safety just before the explosion. The shot of him jumping in as the explosion comes in behind him, that alone is what won them the Academy Award.
Yeah. But now, I don't quite understand whether this is how fire would work, though. I feel like it would look for any oxygen. Like, wouldn't it have actually spread into the side room?
She would have been turbo dead.
Okay.
Like, she would have been turbo dead.
Like, maybe if she had, like, managed to slam the door shut and brace it, like, she might have been okay. But I feel like it would have escaped out of any possible vent, and it wouldn't have been so focused on going straight down the tunnel.
And I remember, for some reason, in my head, I'd always kind of envisioned, like, when I thought about the movie, that, like, she did close the door. And then upon rewatching it, I was like, it was just open.
She's too busy getting the dog landing on her and getting knocked over by that.
She's too busy worrying about Boomer.
Yeah. Well, now it's July 3rd. And we get all the emotional aftermath of all the explosions. The president is regretting not evacuating the city sooner. Russell and Miguel have found where all the other RVs are parked. And then we cut back to Jasmine. We see the desolate wasteland that she comes back out into. And, like, the room that she was in is now, like, just absolute rubble. Like, how did she survive? Even if we want to pretend that the fire would have been directional and not come into that room, the rest of, like, the tunnel has just crumbled around her.
And not to mention, she's still looking great. Like, she's still looking golden. Her hair's still done. She's not, like, sweaty, no makeup stains. Like, her hair's looking, like, fresh out of the shower. Like, maybe they had some dry shampoo in that maintenance closet, but, yeah, she's looking cleaned up.
She's on fleek. Is that a word we still use? I don't know.
Yeah, that's right, fellow youth.
fellow youths.
Yeah.
So the military is getting a briefing about their mission to try to take out the aliens. And then our captains head out to their planes. You know, we've got the Gotcha Victory Dance right here. Harry Connick Jr. starts singing, "Don't get ahead of ourselves. We don't light up till the fat lady sings." Oh, so all these memorable lines, like, no matter how long ago it was that I watched this movie last, I still know everything about the cigars. I've smoked cigars with friends before and made some of the same jokes. Got your victory dance? So all the fighter jets are flying towards battle, and I couldn't help but notice that the only person that's hogging the radio waves is, like, Steven and Wilder. Don't you think a few of the other pilots up there would be like, yeah, I also hope that my mom got out of there. Like, we all may have lost people, buddy. Like, stop talking about your one girl. Yeah, we've heard it a million times. You landed a stripper. Yeah, I'm Steven.
Dalton. Yeah. At least there's other people up there who are also trying to make jokes, and they just keep getting cut off. I'm like, oh, shut up.
Yeah.
Come on. And not funny.
Wilder would be the most annoying person to have in your squadron. I mean, yeah. He's up there and he's doing his, like, I don't know, his minister voice, whatever it is, you know, where it's like,
can ooh. You imagine you're one of the other probably, like, I don't know, like 20 guys out there and you are flying in against a literal alien threat. Like, this is the scariest moment of your life.
Yeah.
Like, you have no idea what to expect. There's nothing that could have prepared you for this. And this guy's working on his quick five. Yeah. Like, he's going on Letterman next week. Like, he's just working on his impressions act. Like, he's, you know. He's doing his SNL audition tomorrow. He's working through some stuff.
Yeah, it'll be over tomorrow.
They should have just cut to another pilot rolling their eyes. this guy.
Oh, this not him again. Fuck.
Like, I hope they get him first, man.
Every morning, yak yak yak.
Oh, red 3, fox 3, you.
And like you said, flying towards this alien threat, and they fire the missiles at the ship, but it has a shield. And they're like, damn, they got shields. Well, duh, it's an alien threat. You don't know what you're flying into. Of course they've got shields. Fuck.
They're like, hold on, boys. I thought their ship would be made out of paper mache. I don't understand what went wrong here.
Yeah. And we get the aerial battle. Oh, no, you did not just shoot that green shit at me. Then Jimmy gets blowed up, and we get, I mean, you wanted an eye roller, but right here we get some great eyeball acting from Will Smith, when is the Jimmy, no, but the rest of his face is covered up, except for his eyes, which just bug out. Oh, so much intensity in your eyes, Will Smith. Solid eyeball acting.
So, sorry, but the way that he yelled Jimmy, no, I couldn't help but laugh. Every time since I was a kid, when he goes, Jimmy, no! Crack me up.
I also don't understand what Jimmy was thinking. Like, you're being chased at a very high speed. The minute you veer, you have to slow. Why would you, like, you're, I don't know. What did you think was going to happen?
He said he was like, I can't breathe. Guess I'll just die then. Guess I'll just accept that I'm going to die.
That seems like the better option in this situation.
Yeah. Like, high-speed maneuvering is one of the few things that you would have been trained for in this scenario.
Yeah.
You know? You know that you gotta, like, do all your clenching and all your rolling your toes and whatever, getting your blood flowing. You don't just go, I can't breathe, guys. Boop, take your mask off and just like, point her down.
Yeah. But you said it yourself. I mean, he's just too busy working on that solid five.
He's like, oh, Letterman's never going to invite me over to the chair now. And he nosedives.
He was too busy writing jokes while they covered that in flight training school.
I was trying to figure out if he was doing a Martin Luther King impression. And if so, whether or not that's racist or not.
I was actually thinking more of a Jesse James or Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jesse Jackson. I was thinking that was more what he was going for. Because it was less about let freedom reign, and it was more about, you know, God will smite thee or whatever. Like he was preachier.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so Steven manages to take out one of the alien ships by blocking the window with his parachute and then ejecting out of his own jet. He's so proud of this one ship that he's taken out. Way to make a dent in their armada.
Yeah.
He opens up the spaceship and punches out the alien, welcome to Earth. Now that's what I call a close encounter. You know, you kind of wanted that line punctuated with a Will Smith, woo! You know, but he's kind of lucky that the physiology of the aliens is such that punching it in the head will knock it out. And one punch, it's out for hours.
This guy's got an arm. Like, there's a reason that he played, I think he played Muhammad Ali in a movie. There's a reason.
Yep.
Yeah, yep. There's a reason. He's got fists like him. Hit him with that quick jab. One punch, that's all you need. Lights out.
I do also love the line when he's dragging the alien through the desert, where it's, what the hell is that smell? Like, yeah. He gets so angry. But I read that this was an improvised line from Will Smith, and it actually has nothing to do with the alien. It's actually because the filming location is a dried out salt lake bed. And apparently when the wind hits it just right, you catch a whiff of like all the dead fish that are in the soil. So, so it was actually, he was legitimately asking, what the hell is that smell? Like, I guess no one warned Will Smith. Conveniently, Jasmine, though, finds a dump truck that also conveniently has keys in the visor, which a movie trope I hate. I know I've mentioned it before on the show. Keys in the visor. Stupid.
Has anybody ever actually done that? I've never. I don't plan on having my car get stolen anytime soon.
Yeah, I think the last time I mentioned the stupidity of keys in the visor, I also mentioned I already feel weird about having my garage door opener in my car. The funniest thing about it, though, is I had some work done on my car, and I wasn't going to be able to pick it up before they closed. And I'm like, well, they always put keys in visors in movies. Can you just lock my keys in the visor? And they're like, well, we won't put it under the visor, but we'll put it under the floor mat. It's like, oh, okay. So there you go. That's the second place to look for keys. Car mat.
Any car thief listening? Write that down.
You heard it here first. The more you know. I'll put in the more you know jingle again.
You can put this down as an educational podcast now.
There we go. I'll check a new box. Yeah. So she starts picking up random survivors, including the First Lady of the United States. And back to David on Air Force One, who is sick. I love the presidential barf bags, though. Those are amazing. And they probably actually exist in that exact form, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they've got to. If they give the president special golf balls, they give him special puke bags, too.
Yeah, okay. So David gets up to go throw up, I guess, and ends up getting in a fight with, like, all the military chief advisors and everything like that. And Julius walks in on them, and he comes to David's protection, and he throws down, like, a good old-fashioned father scolding. And then he also brings up Area 51. Well, why don't we go there? And the president's like, okay, I got this. Hold my beer. I got this guy. There is no recovered spaceship. And we get the guy that, actually, Mr. President, that's not entirely accurate. But I just like how confident the president is in that moment of, yeah, no, Area 51. You're a lunatic.
How dare you suggest?
If only they would have known that years later, Donald Trump would be declassifying everything related to UFOs and all this. And we would just live in a world where the U.S. government freely acknowledges that UFOs exist.
Why couldn't they have predicted the Trump presidency? This movie. Come on.
So Steven gets rescued by a convoy of RVs. But where did he crash? Like, I know that they filmed the scene of him crashing in Utah, but is that where he actually is? Because I did Google that from the Utah border to Roswell, New Mexico, it would be about an 8-hour drive. And I don't think this convoy of RVs has been driving for 8 hours across the desert. Or do they crash in New Mexico somewhere? Like, are they really, like, literally 10 miles from Area 51?
I think that in the same way that ducks fly in a flying V formation.
Or Mighty Ducks. Yeah, hockey players do too.
Yeah, how could I forget? the RVs went in a flying V in order to be more efficient and have better fuel economy, so they were just absolutely peeling down the salt flats.
That's
you heard it here first. That's my hot take of the day.
Science lesson. Bill Nye, the Joel Sims guy.
Okay,
that's what they call me.
Absolutely. There's not a day goes by that I don't hear you refer to it with that shitty nickname I just said of Bill Nye, the Joel Sims guy.
Oh, it's constant. People, you know, all stopping their cars as I'm walking down the street, just screaming it at me. It's like, yes, I know.
This guy. And we get to meet Major Mitchell, who is played by Adam Baldwin, one of the only Baldwins that isn't an actual Baldwin, I don't believe. He was in one of my favorite TV shows of all time, though, Chalk. Oh, I love the show Chalk.
Underrated.
And we meet Dr. Oaken, who is played by Brent Spiner, who was Data from Star Trek. And he, with all his craziness, says, I guess you'd like to meet the big tamale. I always love this because I was a Next Generation watcher. and he was just so different in this movie. I love his character. I'm glad that he comes back for the sequel. Spoiler alert, Colin, I'm sorry for that. He's not actually dead like you think he is. He's just in a coma, and he manages to wake up just in time for the ships to come back to Earth. That's kind of the situation.
I think that's amazing. They just kept a comatose guy around for 20 years, and they were like, we're hoping.
Any day now. But just like in that movie, yeah, he comes awake when the ships arrive. That's what has happened at Area 51, is the one ship that they actually had has come to life. And so the president puts David in charge of trying to find the weakness in their technology. These two are lucky that they found each other just by happenstance, you know? So Steven shows up now at Area 51, and I love the bit here where it's, you want to see my clearance? Maybe I'll just leave this here with you. And he flips back the parachute to show the alien. But, you know, he's awfully cocky for a captain. Like, I don't think captain is that high in the overall grand scheme of military rankings. But he's just throwing around his weight like he's all that.
He's swinging it around, yeah. Walks around, you know, puts it out with two hands, you know. He's showing off. He's letting the world know.
Yeah, I'm not sure where captain falls in the military hierarchy.
Yeah.
It's definitely below president.
Yeah, it's just a smidge.
So yeah, one or two down the line.
Yeah, I think it's president, general, captain. I think that's the order it goes in. Well, and it doesn't help that each military branch also has its own difference. Like captain, I know where captain sits in like the Brooklyn Nine-Nine territory. You know, he's kind of at the top, but not quite at the top. But I don't know whether it's the same when it's translated to Air Force.
Captain's like decently high up. It's just past the middle way, you know, like say there's like the spectrum of like one is like a private, 10 is you're a general. You're like a 6.5.
6.5. Okay.
You're kind of around that spectrum. You're yeah. important. You're not the most important guy, but you're important.
I mean, you know, I've always been confused by the fact that captain isn't the highest ranking in the Navy. But no, they got to come out with admiral. I'm an admiral.
I'm the fleet admiral. Okay. Okay, Captain Crunch, sit down.
So Steven gets led into Area 51 along with all the RVs. This is when Captain Hiller walks up and says, "General, I'm really eager to get back to El Toro." "El Toro?" To which the general answers dramatically, "Hasn't anyone told you? El Toro has been completely destroyed."
And then he just walks away.
Yeah.
Then he just goes, "Deuces," and he's gone. I'm sorry, son. Yeah. Nothing. No. Doesn't care at all. I was like, yeah, all right. Figure this one out later.
Yep. And just to confirm the fact for the audience that what the general said was true, we see Jasmine showing up to El Toro to see this for herself. And so they camp out on this wreckage of the Air Force base for the night. And we've got the scene between her and the First Lady, where it's, "Dylan, come meet the First Lady. I didn't think you recognized me." "Well, I didn't want to say nothing because I voted for the other guy." "What do you do?" "I'm a dancer. Ballet? Exotic." So, you know, a little girl chat in this movie to take away from all the masculinity that we've been experiencing for the last little while. All the testosterone, you know. And we get, you know, a little lesson in, it doesn't matter who you are when the aliens destroy the world. You know, we're all equals now. You're the First Lady. I'm an exotic dancer. Aw, harmony. Hashtag harmony. Yeah.
That's powerful. That means a lot.
So it's alien autopsy, but we find out that it's still alive. That's a bit of a creepy moment still when the hand starts moving.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's so out of like Alien or something. Oh, hey, it works. But then it starts using its ESP too, and it's got like that cicada sounding ESP, and then the alien starts communicating through the doctor, you know, with the whole "release me." Terrifying.
I remember that scene absolutely like spooked me when I was a kid.
Yeah,
when I was younger, that scene freaked me out. That chilled me to the bone.
Yeah,
that scene's one of the ones I remember the most of the entire movie, where I'm just, probably because it is so creepy. It probably gave me nightmares when I was a kid.
Yeah, but the president tries to negotiate. They just want peace. "No peace. What do you want us to do? die, die. And then the whole, is that glass bulletproof? No, sir. And they just American it up and just start firing shots. I love the fact that he goes over to the alien when it's lying down and gives it the old double tap just to confirm that kill.
Venting some frustration at that point. He's like, I'm going to get to fire this thing off and let it out. He's emptying the clip.
Yeah. But the president in this moment has seen the aliens' thoughts and seen what they're planning to do. And we're next. Let's nuke the bastards.
My problem with the whole nuke idea, again, I don't know what they're trying to say about America, but it's like literally like this is like the dick measuring contest now. It's like, oh, you've shown us your shields and your green lasers, but guess what? We took out a whole country back in the day with this thing. Now you're going to see what we have.
Do you not think that in some way this is like relevance is like showing the aliens like in a social commentary way, showing them as a symbol for like American imperialist policy in relation to their like they just invade a place, take all your natural resources, and then they're gone.
Yeah.
Just join in and they're like, yeah, oh, you got some oil over there? We got an annexation coming your way. Hoorah. Yeah. You know, salute the flag.
Like, the movie is so overtly American, but then it's like the aliens are actually out-Americaning the Americans.
So it's time to deploy the nuke in Houston, and this whole scene where they've got the tank that's on the outskirts of Houston confirming whether the target was destroyed, and they celebrate a bit too early that the target has been destroyed, but it hasn't. Oh, the nuke doesn't work. They're in trouble now.
Yeah.
How exactly does Steven find Jasmine so easily when he gets to Los Angeles? Like, do they have a psychic connection or something? He just instinctively thinks that she's going to be alive and then finds her. No problem. Hey, I'm landing here. These are where I see some people. She's got to be in there.
Yeah, guarantee it. It's that easy.
Yeah. Or is he at El Toro? Maybe he's at El Toro now, I guess. So he checked there first. Ah, okay. I think I solved my own problem.
Yeah, he told her to go there.
Yeah.
So if he was going to start somewhere, it makes sense that he would start there.
Yeah. Okay. So the first lady gets rescued just in time to find out that she's bleeding internally and there's nothing they can do. Oh, that feels so extra traumatic for their daughter. Like, hey, mommy's here. Oh, and mommy is dead. But, you know, they've got the scene in the hall where the president goes out and the girl is sitting there and she says, is mommy sleeping now? And fuck, I can't believe I actually teared up on this watch of Independence Day. It's like, what the fuck? Why am I crying right now? Maybe it hit me a bit harder because I have kids now. Like, I was actually legitimately devastated in this moment. I couldn't believe
the
it.
The line that I like the most is when he's like, the doctors say you're going to be just fine. And she goes, you liar. And then they have their, like, presumably, like, their last few moments together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, see, that's
like, I thought that was very nice. Yeah, I think there's a lot in this movie that goes underappreciated, like the actual genuine character arcs that they have. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot more to it than just a big disaster movie about aliens and Will Smith making one-liners. Like, genuinely, all of the characters I find interesting. Like, they're actual personalities. They're not just, like, tropes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that part where he's talking to his wife, that's where it started for me. But then it's like, it just all came out when he was talking to the daughter. I couldn't handle it.
Like, maybe you're just a coward, Sean.
Yeah.
You're just
not patriotic enough.
Yeah, you should have just turned and saluted the flag, and that would have cleared up all emotions inside of you. Repress your emotions like a real American. Just push them down.
So this takes us into July 4th, Independence Day. And we've got drunk David wrecking shit. And his dad comes in. David, I don't want you to catch cold. Get off that cold floor. What did you say? Catch a cold. You're a genius. Oh, he's figured something out. And then to demonstrate his theory, David gets Major Mitchell to shoot a Coke can off the hull. I love how the first shot ricochets. It's like, oops, oops.
I've always wished with that scene that right afterwards, you can see in the background as they like boot it up and they fire off the second shot, that there's somebody being like, you know, dragged away with like a bullet in their leg. Like there's somebody stretcher, one of the doctors, as they're being like hauled out because they caught one in the arm.
See, this is where we need to get better at like deep fake type video stuff so that we can go through an Independence Day and add an eye roll in the Jets. add a guy bleeding in the background. Oh yeah.
I used to like this one, director's cut.
Yeah, there we go. Did I miss a line, though, that explains why he's able to set that can on the ship when nothing else can get through the shield? Like, the bullet can't get through the shield, but his hand can to put the Coke can up there is...
Well, I think at this point they have the ability to, like, use the ship's technology some way.
Okay.
So, like, I think the shield was off before. Like, the same way that they have the ability to, like, turn it on and make it fly.
Yeah.
And also in, like, classic alien movie thing, like, I had the same question, so I just kind of told myself it probably has something to do with, like, organic matter versus, like, something that's obviously, like, has the intention to do harm or is, like, a projectile.
Yeah. Okay, maybe.
You know, Coca-Cola, my favorite organic matter.
Well, there you go. Yeah, the tin can. It's metal just like a bullet would be, you know? It's, like, can it now understand what is a dangerous metal compared to a flimsy metal?
Not even alien life forms can resist that delicious, bubbly taste of refreshing cola, Coca-Cola on a hot day.
You know, you just gave it to me because this was going to be my launching off point with that Coke can flying through the air. It's time for sponsorship corner. So always on the lookout for product placements in movies. This week, Independence Day is brought to you by Coca-Cola, Minute Maid, Fruitopia, Newts and Milk, Arrowhead Mountain Spring Water, Coors Light, Keystone and Sharps Beers, Doritos, Fig Newtons, Quaker, Chevrolet, GMC, and Isuzu Cars, Winnebago, USA Today, Reebok, Samsung, AT&T, Apple, and IBM Computers. I say IMDb too much. Wells Fargo, First Interstate Bank, Whirlpool, and Fox News. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So yeah, David does his computer thing, and this time Major Mitchell is able to shoot the Coke can off the hull, so everything is okay. And what did you do? I gave it a virus. Isn't this, like, the exact same reason that the aliens get taken out in War of the Worlds? Like, aren't they all taken down with a cold or something?
Yeah, it's just, like, instead of a computer virus, it's just, like, the flu.
Yeah.
Oh, look what it did to us. Oh, another hashtag social commentary.
That's deep, man.
Yeah.
I also really like that the solution... The audience is supposed to just believe that the solution to this, like, hyper-intelligent alien race is a computer virus. There's no explanation as to what the computer virus even really is, to my knowledge. There's, like, it's a computer virus, and people go, oh, that means it's bad. That means it can, you know, that's no good. All that they had to do to, you know, get the alien race to be taken down is get them to respond to a Nigerian prince email. That was the trick.
So they need to send this email right into the mothership so it'll filter down to all the ships below. You want us to coordinate a worldwide tactical strike with only a window of a matter of minutes? Yeah. Yeah, that's your job. But yeah, they find out, though, that they have to do it on the mothership itself. So Steven volunteers to fly the ship because he's aware of their maneuverability capabilities. And now we get the birth of that fantastic new bromance between Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum. I just love these guys together. I think they're so great.
Yeah.
The president, meanwhile, fires his Secretary of Defense. He shouldn't have said that he was acting irrationally over the death of his wife. That's your first mistake, Secretary of Defense.
Secretary of bad vibes, that guy. What a jerk.
Secretary of Buzzkills.
Yeah, come on. Secretary of being a narc.
So now comes one of the lines in the movie that I have always hated, because this line is just so over-the-top patriotic. We see the British troops, and they get a Morse code message from the Americans saying that they want to mount a counter-offensive, and the British guy says, well, it's about bloody time, what do they plan to do? And it's just like, I think it's ridiculous that absolutely no one else anywhere in the world has had any plans, that they've all just been sitting around waiting for the Americans to solve the problem.
Yeah, they're all just, please, America, come to our rescue.
Yeah.
Please. They're all just sitting around playing chess waiting for the Americans to, you know.
We don't know what we would do if the Americans didn't come.
Yeah, it's not like one of the most famous science labs in the world, CERN, is in Europe or anything. No, only the Americans have the brilliant minds.
Yeah, again, because they use miles instead of kilometers. So they're like, oh, they must be doing it right.
So at Area 51, they need pilots. And Russell steps forward as a volunteer. And I love his moment here, though, where it's just like, I fly. I can fly. Like, he's obviously, like, three sheets to the wind. But they focus so much on Russell. Like, they're looking for all these volunteers. And then all of a sudden, the story becomes between Major Mitchell and Russell. You know, and they sit around. They want to get to know the pilots. And, you know, it's still like, we'll start with, oh, you, Randy Quaid, the guy whose name is in the top of the credits instead of in the bottom.
Yeah.
You, Mr. Named Character. You get
Yeah, the you, line. The guy who's on the actor's equity.
Yeah, you, who's number 12 on the call sheet. Yeah. And then we find out that, well, he just doesn't drop the crazy act because, on a personal note, he wants payback. And, like, the look on Major Mitchell's face when he says that is, again, it's another one of these, this guy. I've dealt with these guys before.
Yeah.
And we get a scene of Stephen marrying Jasmine for no particular reason. You know, just so she can be a widow if he doesn't come back, I guess.
He's like, you get my Camaro that I got for being in the military. Enjoy.
Yeah. Well, it might help get her some sort of pension if he... Okay, there we go. Yeah. Okay. Inheritance, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. David and Connie are the witnesses because I guess they're the besties out of all the people that are left on the base. And then we get the rousing Independence Day speech from the president. Now, it's funny that you were talking so much about nukes just a few minutes ago. Fun fact about this speech. It is filmed on August 6, 1995, in front of an old airplane hangar that was once used to house the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And the bomb was dropped on, get this, August 6th, 1945, exactly 50 years earlier. Like, on the 50th anniversary, they're doing this big speech about how they're going to nuke the aliens in front of the hangar that housed the death machine that killed a bunch of people in Hiroshima. Like,
yeah, committed one of the worst wartime atrocities of all time.
Yikes. Like, you guys couldn't have done it the next day instead? Like, couldn't have waited a day? And so, you know, he talks about how this is going to be the largest aerial battle in the history of all mankind. If we succeed today, the 4th of July will no longer be just an American holiday. Today we celebrate our Independence Day. And I'm surprised that we didn't just have people shooting guns in the air. Yeah!
No, I swear to God, by the end of that speech, I had an AR-15 in my hand and I was standing in salute of the flag by the end. I don't even know where the AR-15 came from. Like, I don't have a license for this thing, but it was there. Like, it was slung over my shoulder. I had a Budweiser beside me on ice. Like,
and just a bald eagle on your shoulder, perched on your shoulder.
Yeah. For some reason, I suddenly knew a whole lot about Dale Earnhardt Jr. Like,
so the president, to add to the patriotism, he's going up to fight himself because he's a pilot, General. He belongs in the air. And if it was true, if this movie was a true story, it would mean that he is the first president to personally lead troops into battle since James Madison in 1814. I think that's probably a war that was retaliation for the last time the White House was destroyed.
Well, again, you already mentioned earlier how Bill Clinton played sax on The Tonight Show, and his band are kind of like soldiers in their own right. So that's got to count for something.
Soldiers of soul.
Yeah. Soldiers of sax right there.
Yeah. I think I might have just caught a possible angry tweet. It was the Arsenio Hall show he played on, which makes it even cooler.
Yeah. Shows he's really for the culture.
Well, that's what they call him. They call him America's first black president.
Yeah. So while saying goodbye, Steven promises that he'll be back to fire off fireworks. Don't worry, little boy. We're going to have our fireworks after all. And then Julius gives David some Arisic bags, and David gives Dad a Bible and a yarmulke. All the pilots start getting prepared in their planes. Russell has a picture of his kids in his plane. Picked a hell of a day to stop drinking. And his kids looked so proud of him. How is that one kid not Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Yeah.
One of his kids, I swear.
Yeah, the youngest. I thought so for sure.
Yeah.
So I remember having that exact thought when they like showed the first shot in the trailer. I was like, how did I forget that Joseph Gordon-Levitt was in this?
Yeah.
It wasn't him. It wasn't him.
So they are set up in their alien ship. I love that oops moment where they've got the post-it note on the steering column for directions. And then he crashes into the back wall. Oops. But I mean, when he flips the post-it over, now your right and left is messed up. Oh, are you going to be able to cope with that?
Yeah, he's going to need to hold out his fingers and check which way is left. You know, he's going to need to give it the hold on a second here.
Yeah. And yay, Steven, who has always wanted to get to space, gets to go to space. It's a good thing we threw in that little moment of the NASA letter earlier where we found out that he was rejected by NASA, but nope. Who's laughing now, NASA?
Yeah.
I'm going without you. But the autopilot kicks in near the ship. But how come out of all the places in this ridiculously huge mothership, why do they get parked right in front of the control room?
Yeah, they got the front row seat.
Yeah, that's an awfully convenient plot point right there that they have to hide, you know?
I've always kind of thought that it was almost like the ship itself was taking them to like a docking bay or something.
And that's what it seems like is a docking bay, but there's so many ships on this mothership that it's like, well, why is it the front row seat?
Yeah, and the ship also seems to be the size of a planet almost, or at least a moon.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they were like, there's gotta be thousands, like millions on here.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's time for the humans versus aliens dogfight. I read that the drumbeat in the score during the battle scenes spells die in Morse code.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Fun little Easter egg. The ship over Area 51 is preparing to fire its primary weapon, and they're all almost out of missiles. And here comes Russell. But when they ask him to identify himself, why does he salute?
Because he's drunk.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's also, like, it's a new fighter jet to him. I wouldn't want to take my hands off the wheel. I don't know how this thing handles, you know?
When his ghost riding the fighter jet, you know?
Yeah. But when his missile gets stuck, he makes the ultimate kamikaze sacrifice. This explosion, though, of the ray gun is just the Empire State Building effect upside down. They just recycled that image for this shot.
Oh, wow.
So back on the ground, he did it. The son of a bitch did it. And so they tell them to get on every wire around the world and tell them how to bring those sons of bitches down. And once again, American arrogance. They feel like they're the only ones that thought of this. No one else has realized that, hey, if you go for the main gun, that's what's going to bring them down. So thank God the Americans are there to tell us.
The problem with that is like, it's not enough to just shoot at it from the side. Like, you clearly see, like, people shooting at it and the gates get in the way around the gun.
Yeah.
It's like, tell the rest of the world they need to sacrifice one guy to take this thing out. Like, because...
Yeah, draw straws, boys.
Even to try to shoot it, you need to still get that angle of going straight up into the gun.
Yeah, even if you fire a missile,
Which you're immediately going to put yourself in danger, because they have, like, these alien ships seem to have thousands of ships.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just seems like a really risky proposition to just be like, oh, we found the way.
Mm-hmm.
Kamikaze style. Like,
Let's hope every country has a Dennis Quaid of their own.
Yeah.
Randy Quaid.
Find your craziest SOB and send him up.
Yeah. Nick Cage can take one out then. So.
Yeah.
That's why they need to hire Tom Cruise for the movie.
Oh, mm-hmm. There you go.
They need the craziest son of a bitch in the country.
Yeah, I'm home! Yeah, that's how Scientology works, isn't it?
Maybe that'll be Top Gun 3.
Yeah.
Top Gun 3 and Independence Day 3 will intersect.
There you go.
That's what Tom Cruise is going to say to Xenu when he eventually, goes on to the next plane. He's going to go, I'm home!
So David and Steven, meanwhile, are trapped. Their ship has been locked into place, and so they have to hide from the control room that they're parked right in front of for some reason. And David, once again, uses his chess analogy by saying, checkmate. So they decide to light up their cigars, and he uploads his program. And his program is called the Jolly Roger. Is there something about pirates in the Jolly Roger that I'm missing? That's why you would choose that as your name for this program?
It's got to be a reference to something.
Like, you raise... The Jolly Roger is the skull and crossbones, right?
Yeah, it's the flag.
So, do you raise that if you're attacking or if you're in times of peace?
No, you raise it... That's, like, how people know that they're fucked.
Okay.
So yeah, like, I think it's a sign to, like, would... identify that you're a pirate.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when Colin said it more, it's a sign to show that you're fucked. I think that's the more eloquent way.
Yeah. But yeah, they say, do you think they have any idea what's about to happen? No idea. I love the moment where they're sitting in front of the window waving. No idea, with the big smile on their face. But it's a good thing that David gave them the hint by making sure that the virus that he uploads has a laughing skull and crossbones on their computer screen. Because, you know, you actually see the alien look like he's like, wait a minute, I think I know what this might mean. The flashing lights on the front of the helicopter earlier didn't work for me, but skull and crossbones, that I get.
I like to think that this guy knew that he could make a virus that could, like, destroy this whole fleet. And he still thought that it was appropriate to spend a couple extra hours programming, like, an animated GIF of a skull and crossbones. Yeah. Like, he still dedicated man hours to making sure that there was an animated, 8-bit skeleton laughing as you lose.
Yeah.
You know, or as they get wiped out.
So, as they fire off the nuke, Steven yells the ironic, peace! And this... though ends up jolting them free of their restraints, and they get out of there. And I do want to say that after watching the scene, I went back and decided to time it out. That 30-second timer goes for 95 seconds.
I knew there was something hinky going on.
Yeah, the supposedly urgent scene, they draw it out for 3 times what it's actually supposed to be. But they get back to Earth. We see the victory of downed spaceships all over the world, including a couple of very extreme cultural stereotypes in these shots. And then we get the hero shot of David and Steven walking through the desert, smoking their cigars, and, like, just slow motion. They make the women run to them. That's how manly they are in this moment.
What a big dog move.
And then we get the very end shot where they've kissed their women, because for some reason Connie is just, she's into David again, you know, unearned, totally unearned. But we get to see the flaming debris from the ship that was over the planet raining down. Don't you think there should be more of a sense of panic to avoid possible shrapnel? Like, I know it's far away now, but that was a big fucking ship. You know some of that fiery wreckage is going to be raining down right on your head any minute now. Maybe it's like, hey, time to duck and cover, guys, instead of just enjoying the light show.
Yeah, they're just chilling. They're just taking it easy.
I was trying to think, yeah, the ship, it's 15 miles wide. And no one seems concerned at the fact that, yeah, a lot of debris is going to come down, but at some point, this massive hunk of a ship is going to hit the planet.
Yeah, you didn't vaporize it.
And so it's kind of like reminds me of, like, Man of Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Or even, like, in Avengers or whatever, when they have those massive big, I don't even know, space worm things, whatever they are.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, like, in later movies or whatever, you see, like, the trauma of all these, like, husks still, like, covering the city and stuff.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, Spider-Man Homecoming. Absolutely.
But, yeah, I just feel like I would be a little bit worried about, you know, the dust that would be kicked up when this massive, and all the debris that would be kicked up when this massive thing hits the planet.
Yeah,
like, I think, like, they said the 15-mile, or even if, like, the 4-mile ones they were talking about, there's an implication that there's, like, hundreds of those across the globe, across, mm-hmm. like, all major cities. Yeah. So they can wipe out as much of the population as possible. All of those are about to hit the ground. Mm-hmm. So 100 of the biggest asteroids that have ever hit the Earth are about to hit the Earth at the same time, and they're just like, man, Let's smoke these cigars and go make love to our women. Ha, ha, ha.
Age of Ultron told me that it doesn't take anything that big or from that high up to kill everything if you've got all of them falling at once. And, like, they're lucky that this Area 51 ship that comes down is in the middle of nowhere. We've established Area 51's in the middle of nowhere. But, yeah, the rest are floating over cities, as far as I know, or moving on to other highly populated areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about all the extra ships that are flying around? Those don't just, like, disappear. They don't just turn into
that. Yeah, all the stuff. Yeah, there's all those little ships that I assume are just dropping from the sky. But then also, like, the main ship that got blown up, like, some of that debris is going to start entering the atmosphere soon and be, like, plummeting toward, like, I feel like
I would reckon almost all of it is going to start plummeting.
Yeah. Like, I feel like they might have actually inadvertently ended the Earth. Just by creating the world's biggest amount of debris plummeting. They might knock it off its axis or something.
And like you said, with the dust in the atmosphere, yeah, there you go. There's 10 years of nuclear winter, you know?
Yes.
But there we go. Fireworks show, the end, and that is Independence Day. I couldn't believe how low Vivica A. Fox was in the credit list, though, as I watched the credit. Like, she doesn't even have, like, an individual credit. She has one of those credits where she has to share it with two other people. And, like, her character is pretty major in this movie, I thought.
They gave Boomer more of a credit than they gave her.
So, Colin, Joel, on IMDb, it scored a 7.0 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 59. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 67% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 75%. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like a nuke in the mothership, hit us with some reviews!
Alrighty then. So, yeah, I went to Rotten Tomatoes for all these. So Brian S. says 2 out of 5 stars, a very bad film. It starts out well, but it soon spirals down into an empty and shallow big-budget knockoff of better alien invasion movies. For a film that costed a lot, there's not actually much to offer. It's way too soft due to its PG-13 rating, and all of these sci-fi explosions just feel repetitive and exhaustive after a while. The film is also hilariously cliched, and the characters are very thinly written. It's got a couple moments that made me chuckle, but it would have worked as a much more serious science fiction flick. Apart from some good alien effects, which you don't see that often, by the way, and a good performance by Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith, and I want to say he wrote Will Smith, S-M-I-T-T.
Same person that said cost it, so...
Yeah. And even Smith's character is badly written and sometimes very annoying. Overall, I was very disappointed with Independence Day. There's a sequel which also came out, but it's supposed to be even worse. And since this film is already shit, I certainly won't be seeing it. Bad and highly overrated movie.
I read that Ewan McGregor went on record of saying that he thought everybody's actor card should be revoked for participating in this movie. He really hated this movie. He thought this was what was wrong with Hollywood, was these kind of movies. And it's kind of like, well,
okay,
Star
Phantom
Wars.
Menace.
Yeah,
I was about to say. Yeah, you ever seen the prequels, buddy?
Yeah, you might have had a front row seat for those ones.
Ewan McGregor. Like, and I mean, I like this movie, but he also did The Island, which is, like, not that far off of Independence
Day. I was really glad that I had forgotten about that movie until right now.
Yeah.
I watched it recently. I actually don't mind it. ScarJo, man. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Michael Bay classic. It's one of the pioneers of the yellow and blue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sure is.
All right. Chris K. gave the movie 3.5 out of 5 stars. He said, really good watch. Would watch again and can recommend. It's Will Smith fighting invading aliens and Jeff Goldblum being almost annoyingly smart. The alien aspect of the movie and the story are all great, but there's also a lot of humanizing scenes to keep the audience reminded of for what the Terrans are fighting.
Okay.
I'm sure there is a supercut version that reduces the movie to 45 to 60 minutes of good old alien fighting and investigation, but it's nothing that's actually worth skipping. If you're into alien invasion apocalypse movies, then make sure you put this on your to-watch list.
Okay, yeah.
Forte K says 5 out of 5 stars. That's right, ship all banged up. I'm lining up all your friends right beside you. Welcome to Earth. Alien invasion never looked so cool. This is every bit of a talent and big budget CGI in the 90s, all focused into a single point in 1996. We could have probably cut out the entire section of movie that involves that drunk pilot and his family that meant really nothing and got some random pilot in a jet to sacrifice himself, and it would be just as good. It's the only negative in the movie. Some people and plots have no real impact on the audience, but it's overshadowed by all the good things it does.
He's the one that brought Will Smith to Area 51, though. Like, if it wasn't for this convoy of RV drivers and the crazy guy that was convinced aliens were real, I think you need him.
Yeah. Scott F., 0.5 out of 5 stars. I just had to include this one just because it was so, so low. He says, I just wanted to leave a half star to do my part to knock this movie down a notch. I can't believe this movie is even still talked about to this day. Aliens and lasers cannot turn a lowbrow comedy into a sci-fi movie, and even as a comedy, it is subpar. Wisecracking, making jokes while punching aliens in the face, nonsensical plans, head-exploding misrepresentations of how technology works, fighting lasers with machine guns, uninteresting and terrible-looking aliens, off-the-charts stupid. I could go on, but I did what I came to do. Half star. No star if I could. Bundling up the people that like this movie and sending them to another planet would make Earth such a better place.
That guy's half star review to Independence Day is to the aliens what the drunk pilot's ship was to their gun.
Oh.
He was flying the nuke in there. His 0.5 star review is like, this will show up.
And then this last one, just because it was so random and I didn't really know what to make of it, but I wanted to include it. It's from Jamal S. He says 4 out of 5 stars. Nothing like a movie where a Jew and a black man end up saving the world.
Okay. Those are some good ones. Yeah, so 7.0 and 75% from audiences, 59 and 67% from critics. Joel, our special guest, where does this fall for you?
This film is a tricky one because I recognize all of its flaws as a movie. I recognize that the plot is pretty ridiculous. Yeah. They kill all of the aliens with a computer virus and then they just don't care. They don't think about how it's going to destroy the rest of the world, whatever. But on the other hand, like, I love it. I love it. It's so fun to watch. It's just, it's so enjoyable in just how over the top ridiculous it is. The things that person criticized with being absolutely stupid are the things that I enjoyed the most when I was a kid. When I was a kid, the idea of seeing an alien and just giving it like cold cock, that was such a badass move. Yeah. Like the line, welcome to Earth. Like I can hear it perfectly in my mind after the first time I watched it all those years ago. And just on pure nostalgia factor alone, it holds such a special place in my heart as like an introduction to just pure schlocky action.
Yeah.
Although I still think that it does that better than a lot of movies do, and that, like I mentioned earlier, I think it does a good job of focusing on actual characters. A lot of them are ridiculous. A lot of them are kind of poorly acted. Sorry, Dennis Quaid.
Randy Quaid. You got to stop saying Dennis Quaid.
Got to give some respect to Dennis. My apologies, sir. You're Randy. You're not as good as your brother is, unfortunately.
He's the Beau Bridges to Jeff Bridges. That's what he is.
That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what crazier. It is. But crazier. I got to give this one like an 8.5. It's something that I can turn on and enjoy every single time I watch it. Is it a masterpiece? No. But it doesn't have to be to have merit. You know?
Yeah, I know for me, like over the top patriotic images aside, it got me in the feels this time and I wasn't expecting that. But I recognized it for how well paced it is on this watch.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that they don't linger too long on one scene and it does cut between these different characters. And so you see all these snapshots of their life and it helps invest you in them, I think, and it moves the story along. And I love how it has like the 3 days and it's 3 very clear acts because each one is a different mood. But yeah, I mean, the patriotism is definitely over the top. But Colin, what about you? What do you think about Independence Day on this view?
I haven't watched this movie in probably 20 years.
Okay.
So it's always kind of been a movie to me that I really remember enjoying, but at the same time, it's just like kind of just been like stuck in the back. I don't ever feel like a need or a desire to really watch it.
Mm-hmm. You never crave it.
Yeah.
I've always seen it as one of those movies that like you don't ever want to watch, but it's on when you need it most.
Yeah.
Like 3 in the morning on CBS. Yeah. Like, nobody seeks out Independence Day.
Yeah. Like, and watching it this time around, I feel like when I watched it as a kid, I just fast-forwarded between all the scenes that didn't have Will Smith. Because when I was watching it this time, I was like, I thought there was more Will Smith in this movie. I thought like he was I thought he was a way bigger figure in this movie, but he literally doesn't show up until probably half an hour in.
Yeah, yeah, his introduction is late.
He doesn't have a substantial amount of screen time. Yeah. Like, Jeff Goldblum and the president even are way more important than Will Smith.
Yeah, is. And that's what I was going to say. And when I watched it this time, I realized the main center of the story is the president and Jeff Goldblum. But if you would have asked me before watching it this time, I would have said that this movie is about a fighter pilot and a crop duster.
Yeah.
Because
I totally agree.
That I remember the first alien, like, a dog fight, really, mm-hmm. like, that's the standout scene, and then the scene of Russell flying into the gun or whatever and exploding the ship, like, those are the two standout moments for me, and I was watching that, I was just like... I was, and because of, like, Disney Plus, I watched on Disney Plus or whatever, and they're notorious for, like, editing and cutting stuff out of the movies for the streaming service, and I was just watching, and I was like, am I watching some weird Disney Plus cut that I'm, like, things just seem off, like, it's not what I remember.
Well, what you actually didn't see in the Disney Plus cut was the, about 47 minutes into the film, Will Smith does a pro-American nationalism, anti-alien, family-friendly rap.
Oh, okay.
And they cut that from the Disney Plus version.
Okay.
Yeah.
They didn't think it fit with the rest of the movie.
So, okay, so now you're kind of watching this movie with fresh eyes, in a way. You know, like, it's almost like some of these other scenes you're watching for the first time. So, I mean, now that you've got the bigger picture, what do you think of this movie?
It's hard, because I also find, as a kid, I did not pick up on, like, the just, like... in your face, like, we are America, and America is the best, and everybody will bow before America, even the aliens.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I found that, like, a little bit difficult to stomach. So, I mean, yeah.
So much machismo. Yeah.
Like, it's still definitely, like, an entertaining popcorn movie for sure. Mm-hmm. But I would probably fall in the, like, 60% range.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's totally fair.
Yeah. And I think I'm happy to fall right between the two of you, where I think I'm happy with the 70%, because, yes, the patriotism is really a lot. It's they lean into it hard. But, God, the jokes still made me laugh. The sad daughter made me cry. I mean, it's a big mindless movie, and, yeah, I love a good disaster movie, so why not? Why not? So I'll split the difference on you. Colin's 60, Joel's 80, I'm 70. That sounds good to me.
Nice.
There we go. Right on. So there we go. That is Independence Day, and that's our movie for this week. A big, huge thank you to our special guest for this week, Joel Sims. Joel, thanks for being here. You like to have last-minute notes. Is there anything I missed?
You know what? This movie, I didn't feel the need to really go as in-depth with or record as many notes for, because it's one that I've seen, like, a handful of times throughout my life that I just kind of want to sit down and take it in again through the eyes of, like Colin said, like, my perception of what it was when I was a kid and, like, how I can imagine myself watching it for the first time at my grandma's house when I was supposed to be asleep. And I was like, I just kind of want to be taken back to that moment. The only thing that I personally missed that I feel is very important to mention is on the topic of a film about American heroes and the brave men and women who sacrificed their lives for our country, I just want to make a quick notice to remember the life of my favorite American vice president, who unfortunately passed away on April 19th of this year, the one, the only, Mr. Walter Mondale, vice president of the Carter administration. May you rest in peace.
I feel bad laughing, but I know exactly why you're doing that.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Walter Mondale fan. Keep his legacy alive for us.
Well, thank you for coming. Do you want to do another half-assed plug of your social media that you don't care about actually sending people to?
Honestly, this time I'm good. I just want to give another solid shout-out to our man, Walter Mondale. May you rest in peace.
Okay, right on. Well, if you like that show, one thing you can do for us that really helps us out is, well, tell your friends. Oh my God, word of mouth is so important for us. We have declared ourselves the official rival podcast of Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. And so we need everybody to tell people so that we can rise up and crush Conan O'Brien's numbers, but we all need to pitch in to help. Or if you want to go above and beyond and help drive us up those charts on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcast, go and give us 5 stars. Doesn't matter what you say in those reviews, put anything in and give us 5 stars and help drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
We're coming for you, Conan, you lanky ginger fuck.
Oh, we haven't gotten that mean with him yet.
I'm putting a line in the sand. We're coming for you. There's a reason you only had the Tonight Show for like 7 months.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now I feel like I have to retract my statements over the last couple episodes and say, okay, Matt Gourley, Sona Massessian, Conan O'Brien, we do love you a bit more than apparently Joel Sims does.
Wait. Love you, Conan. More of a Letterman guy.
And as always, be sure to check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our podcast episodes, as well as our social media. We have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have Twitter. Go on there, give us some likes, give us some follows, give us some shares. If you want to write to us, you can reach us by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Drop us a line and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about them on our show.
And if you want to be a producer of our show, just like Joshua Blum from the 13th Hour podcast, and donate to us, just go over to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.
I knew you were going to give me gold. I wasn't expecting you, lanky ginger fuck.
Coming for you, pasty bastard. There's Marge versus the monorail, and now there's I Used to Like This One versus Conan O'Brien's existence.